cleanup continues after floods devastated communities throughout Ohio and Kentucky. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, we'll discuss the recovery ahead. We'll also hear about the state budget that Ohio House Republicans passed, what's in it and what's not, and we'll talk about how Cincinnati City Council members want to spend proceeds from the sale of the Cincinnati Southern Railway and what that could mean for all those potholes. Joining me now to get us started, our Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter, Sylvia Goodman. Welcome back, Sylvia.
Glad to be here.
And Cincinnati Inquirer breaking news reporter, David Ferrara. Welcome back to you too, David.
Happy to be here.
Sylvia, which parts of Kentucky saw the worst flooding?
So in this flooding event, the worst was really in western Kentucky, and then it moved into central Kentucky. So a lot of that heavy, heavy rain was in mostly western Kentucky. I mean, we saw up to 15 inches in parts of the state. But as that, you know, water made its way into the river, into, you know, various Kentucky rivers, it moved up and it was causing a lot of damage in central Kentucky and kind of in the Ohio Valley area. So Louisville is currently still experiencing quite a bit of flooding as well.
How many fatalities in Kentucky have there been at this point?
So we've seen so far 7 people have died in flooding-related deaths. I mean, a lot of those have been people in their cars or at least related to, you know, having tried to drive through floodwaters. We also really tragically early on in this flooding event, a child was walking to their bus in Frankfort, Kentucky, that's central, and he drowned and was picked up by floodwaters. So, I mean, some really tragic deaths here. And then, you know, still trying to deal with the damage now.
Right. It's just heartbreaking. Sylvia, did the flooding hit communities that are still recovering from previous severe weather events?
Yes, that would be correct. I mean, we're currently dealing with we're actively dealing with this flooding in western and central Kentucky. And then just a couple months ago in February, we had severe flooding in eastern Kentucky. And then, you know, a lot of those communities were also affected by previous natural disasters. We've had a lot of natural disasters in the state, tornadoes, wind damage, and flooding across the state. And so some of those communities were affected by both of those two flooding events. I mean, that's a pretty small overlap, but there's a few places. And then also still recovering from some really severe weather, you know, in 2021 and 2022. I mean, these are long-term cleanup projects.
Yeah. David, which communities have been hit hardest in greater Cincinnati?
It's primarily the riverfront communities, particularly New Richmond, parts of Covington and Newport, especially near the Ohio River, communities along the Little Miami River and the Licking River down in Butler County, or down near Butler and near Pendleton County, not in Campbell, have been struck particularly hard. And a lot of these communities have thought back to the flood of 1997, which was the last severe storm to strike them.
Yeah, I was here for that. I was actually working at the Inquirer at the time and spent some time in Falmouth. David, several counties have declared emergencies, right? Tell us about those counties and how that helps with the recovery effort.
That's right. So communities like in Hamilton County, in Kenton County, Campbell, have declared states of emergency to free up additional resources to try and expedite the cleanup process. So a lot of that looks like, again, especially for residents that have flooding in their basements, getting additional resources towards them. At this point, the floodwaters have receded in a lot of these communities, so there's an opportunity for them to reopen roads and start mud cleanup.
Yeah,
especially down by the riverfront. I'm sure a lot of folks in Cincinnati have seen the mud that has built up alongside the riverfront park there.
Right. Are there still parts of greater Cincinnati waiting for floodwaters to recede?
Depending on the area, yes and no. I mean, some parts that really did overflow do see residual waters, especially backwater flooding. I know parts of New Richmond, the waters have receded, but there's still some inlets and areas that have a little bit of flooding.
Yeah. How long could it take a community like New Richmond to really see the river get below flooding stages and clean up effectively?
Hopefully by the end of either this week or by next week, it should see additional the floodwaters recede and the cleanup process is just beginning. I know that when I spoke to a lot of residents in New Richmond that they, you know, again, like I said, were reminiscent of the flood of 1997 and thankful that this wasn't as bad as it could have been. Mm-hmm. But for a community that's alongside the river, they sort of accepted that this is the new reality, that this is what they have to expect going forward.
Right. Sylvia, you mentioned that flooding's still a problem in parts of Kentucky. How long is it going to take for the floodwaters to recede in some of the communities that have been hardest hit that you've been covering?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't know that I have a solid answer for that. It could take a few more days. I mean, I think most places have crested at the very least. So Louisville, we crested on Wednesday morning, but there's still where you're seeing in Cincinnati area, some places inlets where there's still water, some places right along the river that maybe don't have as good of flood walls or things like that are still seeing some flooding, and cleanup is going to take a really long time. I mean, some communities have been hit really hard. I mean, flooding is just very difficult to plan for a lot of people, and especially for really riverfront communities. I mean, we both have we saw intense flooding on both the Ohio River and then also the Kentucky River, which is the one that runs through Frankfort. And I think that there's a lot of cleanup it's going to take a long time.
Yeah, we've seen photos of those homes that are just surrounded by water. We've heard in your reports people whose basements are just filled with water. David, what kind of precautions are being recommended for people who are cleaning up after the storms? That's something you have to be careful about, isn't it?
Absolutely. And officials are reminding folks to avoid, staying in the water. I remember when I was out in New Richmond, I did see some kids run around playing in the water. Avoid doing that. The water is a little polluted. To say the least. But, if there's food items that have been, impacted, whether the power went out, if utilities were cut off, make sure you discard those food items. If anything's been fully soiled by water, make sure that you, again, discard that. Take proper precautions. Make sure you're wearing gloves and not interacting directly with the waters. And depending on the level of damage, if you have severe damage, you might have to consider some other form of remediation. Again, get rid of mold growth and think about the kind of products you're using versus more minor damage where you might be able to sort of take matters into your own hands.
Yeah. And I've heard sometimes recommending even wearing masks and things when you're cleaning up just because there can be so much toxic stuff in some of these floodwaters, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Sylvia, what is Governor Andy Beshear saying about cleanup and recovery efforts in Kentucky?
Well, he's in full gear working on that. I think last I heard, he's still working on the application for a major disaster declaration here in Kentucky. We've had quite a few of those just in the past couple of years. I think it's been four so far since I think last January, and then this would be our fifth. So he's working on all that federal paperwork. We're already getting some public assistance rolling in here across the state in a few different counties. And really, I mean, it's still to some extent. I mean, we just saw another, I think it was another death, either it was this morning or last night. That was the seventh. And so it's still dangerous in some parts of the state, especially where there's, standing water. Still don't be driving through that. Don't move barricades, all of that. But also, just working on getting people clean water. I think most of that utilities have been working hard to get that solved, but he's been working on that very hard, making sure people have bottled water if they need it, just working on making sure people are safe for right now. And now it's going to start being helping evacuees get back into their homes and working on the cleanup long term, both to public property and to private. So, but I think a big piece of that is going to be asking for that federal help as well.
Well, and Sylvia, these recovery efforts are very expensive. I know state lawmakers tackled the issue of state funding to deal with emergencies like this during their last legislative session. Can you explain what they did?
Yes, it's kind of complicated. So because we had that other major flooding event in eastern Kentucky in February, the topic of disaster relief came up this session. And they very specifically passed a bill to deal with disaster relief for that flooding event. So they created a new fund that the governor can draw from that actually, it didn't appropriate new money, but it took money from other sources to put into this new fund. But that was specifically relegated for that February flooding disaster. And they expanded a cap that they had put on disaster relief spending, so emergency spending that Beshear can do. It used to be $50 million per fiscal year, and they changed that to $100 million over the 2 years. So kind of liquidating funds a little bit earlier or making them available a little bit earlier. But Beshear said that's not enough. And lo and behold, right after the session ended, we have another one of these major disasters that's going to take a lot of money to help clean up. And Beshear is saying that cap needs to go away and that he might need more money before the end of the year. We have a part-time legislature here, so they won't come back until January. Lawmakers are saying that they think that Bashir should focus on what he can do for now. And if it does require a special session, then he should call that and they will take it up if need be. But so essentially Bashir is saying that we could very easily hit up against that $100 million cap from cleaning up and trying to recover from these disasters.
Has the governor indicated whether he's considering calling a special session? I mean, any idea what the thought process is there?
So I would not say that Bashir has said one way or the other. I wouldn't rule it out. I think the kind of phrasing he's used is that he doesn't think he should have to call a special session just to get emergency funding is kind of how he's framed it so far. I think if he does really hit up against that $100 million cap, and especially if there's another disaster, which you can't rule out. I mean, I remember the tornadoes in 2021 that happened in December, right before the session. So he may have to call them back early if he really does hit up against that cap. We'll just have to see how that money end up getting distributed if we really hit that maximum. But I don't think you can rule it out.
And are these caps, are they relatively new for Kentucky? I mean, did the governor used to have more leeway for spending for disaster relief?
Yes. As far as I'm aware, and as far as the governor has said, and legislators too, this is the first time they've put that cap on emergency spending. And it's very specific to the Department of, I think it's Military Services, but, you know, that National Guard and governor emergency power spending sort of situation, they put that cap on for the first time last year. And Bashir was very critical of it when he did that, when the legislature did that. I mean, he's dealt with a lot of emergencies in his time as governor. I mentioned two of them, but also, of course, the pandemic. I mean, we've had a lot of tornadoes and flooding and wind damage in this state in the past in his term as governor. So he was very critical of that at the start. And lawmakers said that it was partially to help them with budgeting, you know, to make sure that they were spending their money correctly, and then also to protect their power of the purse, essentially, and that if Bashir needed more money, he could call them back. He's been critical of that because A, it costs money to bring them back into special session, and then B, it also slows down the process, right? I mean, they can do things pretty quickly when they get into session, but it does take time. It's not something he can do within an hour sort mm-hmm. of thing.
Yeah. And of course, the legislature is controlled by Republicans with a supermajority, mm-hmm. and Governor Andy Bashir is a Democrat. So that you think that factors into this at all?
I mean, you have to consider politics always when it comes to political positions, right? So you imagine that politics does play into it. You know, there's a lot of power balance issues. You know, they're constantly going back and forth about who has the most power between the governor and the legislature and, you know, constantly shifting things around. So you have to imagine that plays into it as well.
Sure. Well, David, I'm almost afraid to ask, but what's the forecast looking like for Greater Cincinnati? Could we get more rain tonight or this weekend?
That's a great question. I have not checked the forecast too much into coming into today, but it does look like that most of the severe storms that we've had over the past week that especially battered the region last week are out of the way. It does seem like we have a little bit more rain in the forecast coming in on Monday, and the chilly weather hopefully will abate as the week goes on. It's been warming up a little bit after we had our frost earlier this week, but I do remember a joke because I just recently moved to the area that my boss told me that if you don't like the weather, just wait a minute because it'll change.
Yep, that's exactly right. Yeah, we can have those 40 degree swings in a day or two. It's crazy. Well, I hope if we get rain, it's not rain that makes things too much more difficult for the good people who are cleaning up. Well, I have been talking with Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter Sylvia Goodman and Cincinnati Enquirer breaking news reporter David Ferrara. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you, Lucy.
No problem.
Up next, we'll hear what's in and what's out in the state budget passed by the Ohio House. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Ohio House Republicans passed a state budget this week. Joining me now to explain what it includes for education, libraries, and more are Ohio Public Media, State House News Bureau reporter and producer Joe Ingles, and correspondent Sarah Donaldson. Hey, Joe and Sarah, thank you both so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Hey there.
Joe, let's talk about what the budget did about funding for education. I know there was there were a lot of moving parts in this. Once the House sent its version of the budget along, what were the provisions for public education?
Well, one thing they did is Governor DeWine had used the Fair School Funding Plan. That was that bipartisan funding proposal that in 2001 lawmakers adopted. And they had been following that to try to reduce over-reliance on property taxes. And Governor DeWine followed through the last phases of that. Now, granted, he didn't use the numbers that schools would have liked him to use. He used some older data. But he did follow through with that funding plan. The House version did not follow through with that. And what they did is instead gave a line item budget number to all the schools for funding. So that was something that was first off the bat kind of controversial. But the big thing that the House did is they ended up saying that we want to give property tax relief. And in order to give property tax relief, we want to make sure that schools are not overspending. So the House decided that 30% was the maximum amount of carryover that a school district could have in their operating budget from year to year. And anything above 30% would be given back to local property taxpayers who were paying into those schools. So they passed that, and the schools are not happy about it, and they're saying that this is going to hurt them, and they're going to fight it as the change goes through the Senate process.
Well, I do want to talk about the Fair School Funding Formula, but first let's talk a little bit more about this provision in an effort to give some property tax relief. Tell me more about what the arguments are for and against that. I mean, is this something that's been in the law at a different kind of percentage point, or is this new, this provision that too much carryover and school districts have to refund that money to property taxpayers?
Well, this is new with the House version. The House is the first version to come out with it. Of course, we've been hearing lawmakers for a while saying they didn't like the fact that some school districts carried over a lot of money year to year, and why are you taxing people when you carry over the money? But the school districts will tell you, and some of them, Marianne, or some of them, Lucy, have the districts are carrying over 300%. Of their, you know, from year to year. So some of them do have a very high carryover. But when you talk to those school districts, they say there's specific reasons for the high carryover. One school district said that the reason they have the high carryover is that they are building buildings constantly, and they're having to constantly move money around to build the buildings. Other ones have specific costs throughout the year that are high, and depending on when you look at that carryover, it might be very high. They're saying that if they have to give that carryover back, that it's going to cause a lot of confusion for taxpayers, because taxpayers may get a very nice little refund check one year, and then the next year they're hit with a huge property tax bill to offset what they didn't get the year before, or what they got the year before. So it kind of creates a chaos in the funding too. But it's something kind of new. This whole process is kind of new, and I think we're going to hear more from the schools and more from different people as we go through this process with the Senate, because a lot of school districts are saying if they have to do this, it's really going to hurt their school district.
Well, and I do want to circle back to the Fair School Funding Formula. You mentioned that that was the basis for Governor DeWine's budget recommendation, that the House decided to go a different direction. For years, we've talked about how Ohio's school funding formula is unconstitutional, and I thought the Fair School Funding Formula was supposed to address that. What do lawmakers say about that aspect of this decision not to use the formula?
Well, and you're right. The Fair School Funding Plan was addressing that issue of over-reliance on property taxes, because that's what was making the funding unconstitutional. And this was supposed to be the final two-year period. But if you listen to House Speaker Matt Huffman talk about this situation, he says you cannot you know, draw up something in one legislature or one general assembly and then make other general assemblies that follow it actually follow through with it. And they think that the fair school funding formula has some flaws in it, and they like the idea of this line item instead. But as the schools would tell you, they're, you know, they might get this line item in this budget, but then in the next budget, it might be much, much lower. And there, because there's no formula really attached to it that they have to, that the lawmakers would have to adhere to, there would be no way to plan for how much you're going to get in the future.
Hmm. Well, I'm sure we'll be hearing more about that as these budget talks continue. Sarah, another hot topic in the budget was state support for a new domed stadium for the Cleveland Browns. What was that debate about?
Yeah, so this has been going on for a bit. You know, the Cleveland Browns are seeking to build a domed stadium in Brook Park, which is a suburban part of Cleveland. So they're looking to move out of the city and to this suburb to build this domed stadium. And they have pitched it to lawmakers as a broader economic development project they want to build. Parking and infrastructure and apartments and businesses and all of that in a kind of community surrounding the domed stadium. And they're asking lawmakers for help. They want $600 million worth of state-backed bonds to build this project. And the Browns, the Haslam family who owns the Browns, they'd have to put some cash up front for the project. But it's proven to be probably one of the most divisive pieces in the budget because Governor Mike DeWine did not put any sort of a bonds package in his proposed version of the budget. He told lawmakers he thinks that they should instead raise the tax on sports gambling operators and that that money should go toward a fund toward sports facilities construction that could benefit all professional minor league, major league sports facilities. So Paycor in Cincinnati, you know, maybe the Crew Stadium for updates in Columbus. But obviously lawmakers have said they don't want to hike taxes on anyone. So they cut DeWine's proposal out of the budget and instead put this bonds package in there.
And Sarah, I understand these bonds will cost the state nearly $1 billion over 30 years. Was that a concern for any of the lawmakers during this debate?
Hear a couple of different perspectives from lawmakers. The vast majority of the Democratic caucus is against this. And of course, Democrats are in the minority here, but they've argued that they feel that the state shouldn't be subsidizing billionaires. But you also hear from lawmakers who say, you know, why are we giving why are we doing a bonds package when we know that every other professional sports team is going to be lining up for money and asking for money down the line? And of course, you see that because I believe you guys over at WVXU were reporting that Paycor and the Hamilton County Commissioners have already put in a request for funding for upgrades to Paycor.
Yep, they sure have. Just did that yesterday, I believe. And I think their request is for $350 million. I might be remembering that wrong, but I think it's less than the $600 million. But I think you're definitely right. They're asking for a chunk of money. Well, Sarah, what does funding for the state's libraries look like in this budget?
So there was a lot of attention paid to what House lawmakers did when they introduced their version of the House budget about a week ago at this point. Right now, under the current system and under the Ohio Public Libraries Fund, libraries get a set percentage of the general revenue fund that the state has. So they have very, I don't want to call it guaranteed, but they have a funding source that's pretty, they can predict it pretty well, and it's pretty reliable. And lawmakers have said that they want to move libraries to a line item in the state budget, like many other agencies that get funding from the state. Libraries say, you know, that we're going to have to come back and fight for our funding every 2 years, and it's just not as reliable. At first, lawmakers also did not provide the increase in funding that the governor was asking for. But after you saw some serious backlash from library patients, from librarians, I mean, I really think there was a whole public campaign across the state where libraries were reaching out to their patrons and saying, reach out to the state house and tell them that we are concerned about our funding being potentially cut. Lawmakers did put in an increase in funding, but It's really important to note that although they put that increase in funding, the way that libraries are getting money is changing from that percentage to that line item.
And some librarians are still worried about that, aren't they, that change?
Absolutely. And I do think, you know, lawmakers have been asked about this and they haven't really, really commented one way or another. But you see libraries and, of course, this budget as well as part of broader conversations on really divisive issues and some of these culture war issues that Republicans are really latching onto. You've seen lawmakers tweeting frustrations about menstrual products being put in men's restrooms at a public library. So, you know, there is a question out there if some of the want to do this right now has to do with Republican lawmakers' broader frustrations with libraries, but also you are looking at a two-year cycle where this budget is leaner and lawmakers and Governor DeWine are looking at places where they can make cuts, and Republican lawmakers say that they should not be beholden, like Joe was talking about earlier with state school funding, they shouldn't be beholden to something that a prior General Assembly has promised.
Well, Joe, you know, the budget is certainly a big topic of conversation in Columbus, but then there's the U.S. economy and everything that's happening with that. Are state officials worried about the volatility in the U.S. economy and how that could affect the budget?
Well, they're looking at that. I mean, you cannot have, you know, every state is looking at that. Every state, the person who has to budget is looking at how the federal economy is going to affect the state. But right now, they're not in any kind of panic mode. And it doesn't seem like that is the thing that's driving this budget that's coming out of the House. They are basically putting line item budgets in there. And instead of having formulas kind of leaning toward that way of funding agencies, it's unclear as to why they're doing that. But, you know, it does give them more ability down the line, say 2 years down the line, the economy isn't doing well. You know, having that line item funding gives them a little bit more ability to jump through hoops.
Well, Joe, I know the budget goes to the state Senate next. What's the deadline for getting a final budget passed? Where are we in this process?
Well, the final budget needs to be passed by law by the end of June. It needs to be passed and signed by the governor. And we forget that, you know, once the Senate will probably get it in a couple, they'll probably do something in a couple of weeks. They're kind of taking an Easter break right now. But then they'll come back and they'll work on tackling it. And, you know, try to get it then. But then it goes into conference committee and they have to work out all those differences that between the House version and the Senate version, what they've added. And they'll have to go back and forth over it. And then it goes to Governor DeWine. And we already know that at this point, Governor DeWine has a lot of questions about a lot of things that could be in that budget. And he had wanted very different funding for certain proposals that have either been eliminated from this budget or funded differently in this budget. So the big question, you know, the stadium funding, that's one example of something that the governor wanted to fund very differently than the House's funding. He wanted to set up a special fund. It was based on taxes on gambling operators. And the Senate didn't go there. So, you know, he's still working with the Senate, trying to get some of his ideas through. And if he is unsuccessful and doesn't like what comes out of the House and the Senate, he could always line item veto, which sets another thing in motion entirely. So there's still a lot of work to be done on the budget. And just because the House did something doesn't mean it's going to stay in there.
Okay. Well, Sarah, let's talk about another proposal that Governor DeWine has been talking about, and that's banning cell phones in schools. Why does the governor say that needs to happen?
So Governor DeWine has been on this issue for about a year now, and he says that he feels that research shows that, you know, students of this generation are on their phones a lot. They have pretty much unfettered access to social media. There's a lot of research that suggests that that increases access to cyberbullying. Students are dealing with more mental health struggles. And he says that, you know, phones don't have a place in the classroom. So this proposal has kind of evolved over the last year. I was at a Dublin City Schools event about a year ago with him where he said, you know, we want to encourage schools to do this. We want them to come up with their own policy, but we want to give them the leeway to decide what that policy looks like. So that was passed last year. There was a bill passed about a year ago, and I think it goes, I think the effective date is maybe July 1st of this year, that schools have to come up with some sort of a policy limiting phone use. But Governor DeWine is now supporting a bill that's in the Ohio Senate that takes that a step further. He says crosses that bridge. And instead of that policy being up to the schools, all schools are going to be asked to have a policy that eliminates phone use during instructional hours.
Sarah, how unusual is it for the state to want a kind of a cookie cutter approach for every one of Ohio's school districts on something like this?
It's pretty rare. Governor DeWine says the last example that he would give is the science of reading curriculum. So you've seen schools pretty universally adopt science of reading curriculum. And that's based on this evidence-based thinking about how you learn how to read based on phonics and phonetics and writing to read better. It's a pretty holistic approach to learning how to read. Well, all schools in Ohio have had to adopt science of reading curriculum under the DeWine administration. And DeWine says that this is just as important. He says every student is affected by literacy and every student is affected by phones and phone usage in schools. So he says it's just as pressing as that, but it is pretty rare.
Yeah. Well, and I know there was a lot of discussion and debate over the science of reading proposal before that became state law. What's next for this cell phone ban proposal? I think you mentioned it's in the Senate right now.
Yeah, so there's a good chance that this gets folded into the Senate version of the budget. The bill sponsor already said that she's looking to get it into the budget. And of course, the budget, as we have seen, is not just about monetary items. You know, there's non-fiscal items that are put in the budget. So it could be put in the budget. I don't anticipate as much debate on an issue like this because we've been told that it's been pretty universally popular pulling phones from schools. You know, I think that there is always the chance that when you're leaving it up to local control versus the state is making the decision with a harder hammer, usually the latter option invites more opportunity for debate, but I don't know that this will be quite as divisive. The one thing I will add is, you know, you have heard some concerns from parents that we also were in an environment where, God forbid, if there's an emergency at the school, if there is an active shooting incident, how would a student potentially contact their parents? But, you know, we've heard from at least one superintendent who says, you know, we have, of course, emergency plans in place if something like that happens, and phones are not part of that equation. Sometimes a student having a phone on them can make the situation worse.
Well, Joe, I know you mentioned that the lawmakers are on a holiday break right now. What's the big thing you'll be watching for when they get back? What do you think the first order of business will be?
Well, the first thing I want to do is try to catch up my work. I know Sarah and I have a lot of things we want to pursue. So we're kind of looking forward to this little bit of a break here. But I think, honestly, while they're on break, they're going to be, you know, they're not going to go home and just not think about this. So I think there's going to be some talking about it and thinking about it. And then when they come back, they'll start putting that into, you know, on paper and into plans and that kind of thing. But I think right now they're still trying to get together with the people involved in the budget, the schools, the education people, and try to, you know, figure out details about, you know, all those items in the budget and if they do need to be changed and how they need to be changed if they do.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau reporter and producer Joe Ingles and correspondent Sarah Donaldson. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Happy Friday. Thank you.
Up next, voters approved the Cincinnati Southern Railway sale. Will city council members agree on how to spend the proceeds? This is Cincinnati Edition. The city sold Cincinnati Southern Railway after voters gave the okay. Now, city council is divided over how to spend the money that sale is generating. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me in this recorded interview to talk about that and other news from City Hall is WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Welcome back, Becca.
Thanks, Lucy.
How much money will the city have to spend from the sale in this next budget?
The Railroad Board of Trustees has decided to send the city $56 million for fiscal year 2026. That starts on July 1st. That's about double what the city would have received this fiscal year if they had continued to lease the railroad to Norfolk Southern.
Okay. And the city is limited in how it can spend that money, isn't it?
Yes, limited by state law. And this was by intention from the beginning. The Railroad Board and City Council supported went to state lawmakers and said, please pass a state law that limits how we can spend this. This is kind of an assurance to residents and to voters who at the time were deciding whether to approve it. The money can only be spent to maintain or replace existing city-owned infrastructure. So a few key things there. It has to be existing. We can't build a new arena with it or even a brand new fire station. Now, the kind of caveat there is that if it's replacing existing infrastructure, like let's say it doesn't make sense to renovate an existing fire station because it's too old and run down, so the city builds a new one to replace it, that would be allowed. Other city-owned infrastructure would be like parks, health centers, police stations, and roads.
Okay. What's the city administration recommending for how to spend this money?
So City Manager Cheryl Long came up with a broad outline of a plan for spending the money way back in 2023 when voters were first considering the sale. It's been revised a couple of times since then over time, you know, with new information and as new priorities come up. Broadly speaking, she's kind of prioritizing a few key things like roads and bridges are kind of one of the main things. And then she's also prioritizing neighborhoods where the median household income is $50,000 a year or less. That's about 30 neighborhoods of Cincinnati's 52 neighborhoods. So there are some projects, obviously, that will benefit the whole city. Roads is one example. And also, you know, a health center or a recreation center in one neighborhood will benefit the surrounding neighborhoods. But there is kind of an extra emphasis on these lower income neighborhoods that maybe haven't seen as much private investment as some of the higher income neighborhoods.
Has city officials already started using this money to make repairs or deal with this infrastructure? I think you've heard some complaints from people wondering why they aren't seeing more improvements, haven't you?
Yeah, I think especially because we are in pothole season. This pothole season is worse than usual because of that major winter storm we had in January, plus the major flooding that we just had this past week. And I do see a lot of comments on social media that are like, why are our roads so bad? Didn't we sell the railroad to fix this? Well, the short answer is the city just doesn't have the money yet. So the $1.6 billion sale price was invested. The goal was always to use only the investment returns to on infrastructure, not to touch the sort of principal of that account. The sale was finalized in March 2024, and the city wanted to spend at least a whole year of investment before pulling on that. So that's why the city won't get any of those new funds until fiscal year 2026. Now, the city was getting the lease payments. We mentioned those from Norfolk Southern. Those were also limited to maintaining or replacing existing city-owned infrastructure. It was just less money available. And so the new money that the city is bringing in just hasn't been available to spend yet.
You mentioned that the city manager is talking about focusing this work on 30 neighborhoods that meet this kind of criteria in terms of median income. Some council members are favoring a different approach. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I should say I think there is agreement among council and city administration and the mayor that there should be a focus on these kind of lower income, less invested in communities. The disagreement here is how to do that and how to define it. So three council members led by Vice Mayor Jan Michelle Lemon-Kearney put forward this kind of Rising 15 plan is what they're calling it back before the voters had approved it. It didn't really get much of a discussion at council at that time, so they brought it back this year to kind of have that discussion again. So they have identified 15 neighborhoods that initially, they said were basically the 15 neighborhoods with the lowest median income, household income, and that those they're calling the Rising 15. They say they should benefit from at least, in addition to kind of the citywide measures that that will be used, that those 15 neighborhoods should get at least 10% of the city's investment revenue from the railroad sale. They're also proposing this separate Rising 15 Economic Development Fund. Now, this would be private funding, so it doesn't meet the definition of existing city-owned infrastructure. But what they're saying is basically the city's going to save some money by, you know, money they would have spent on existing infrastructure. We can now use railroad money for that. So they want to swap that out basically and say, okay, money that's freed up, in their words, from spending that money in that way, they could use on this economic development fund, and that would be given to developers to build housing or other projects in these 15 neighborhoods.
How does that idea, that swap out idea, match up with what was discussed during the campaign to sell the railroad?
You know, we're hearing from some city council members that it's basically the opposite of what was promised to voters. And, you know, in my experience reporting quite a bit on this sale, there was a promise to voters that there would not be this kind of swapping out procedure. Now, it is true that it would technically not violate state law. It would not, you know, cause a city necessarily to be sued over that. But, you know, a lot of voters were skeptical of this idea, like, oh, the state law isn't really going to protect this money because the city's just going to swap it out and spend it on whatever they want. And council members at the time and the mayor were promising, no, we won't do that. We promise. You know, we want these guidelines in place. We know this deferred maintenance issue is serious and we want to focus on it. So it really does not seem to line up with what voters were told.
What's next with all this?
So the city council is currently in the process of deciding what the next fiscal year budget should be. Now, that encompasses way more than just the railroad money. So they're in this usual annual process of doing the budget. That has to be passed by the end of June. So this is one opportunity for this kind of Rising 15 thing to come forward. I will say the city manager has kind of already dismissed the idea of the Rising 15 getting 10% of the railroad funds kind of straightforwardly for this infrastructure maintenance. And Vice Mayor J. Michelle Lemon-Kearney has said she's okay with kind of this other definition of lower income and disinvested neighborhoods. But she is still pushing this idea of the economic development fund. I think it's unlikely that it will happen in this budget, which needs to be passed by the end of June. But it sounds like Kearney and the other two council members she's working with, Victoria Parks and Scotty Johnson, are still really in favor of this idea. They may try to find some other way to fund it, maybe without this swapping out idea. And that could come up really at any time. But the focus right now at council is more so the budget for the next fiscal year.
Well, that makes sense. We have another Cincinnati City Council story to talk about, and that's council considered a zoning change for an affordable housing development this week. Tell us about this project. Where is it? How big is it?
Yeah, so this will be an affordable housing development project in Walnut Hills. This is from Kingsley Development. So the plan right now is two buildings, apartment buildings, that'll have a total of 180 units. And this will be really truly affordable housing. I know we use that term a lot and sometimes without definition. This would be income restricted to households making between 30% and 80% of the area median income. So on the low end of that, that could be a single person making about $22,000 or a family of four making about $31,000.
Did you say how many units are going to be in this?
180
units. 180. Is that, yeah. That's smaller than the original plan, isn't it?
It is. The original plan was about 100 units larger than this. And this is a project that's been in kind of the community engagement process for about 2 years. So it's been a long time coming. And community members initially said they felt the project was too big. It was one large building, initially kind of a U-shaped building. The community council and some other residents pushed back and said, we think it's too big. It doesn't have enough green space. You know, we're a little worried about parking and pedestrian infrastructure, or pedestrian safety rather. And so the developer, you know, over the course of these 2 years, revised that plan, cut out about 100 units, primarily so that they could make this kind of a smaller footprint and add more green space. And that just necessitated the loss of those units.
Well, and some council members raised concerns about that change, making this project smaller. What did they have to say?
Yeah, specifically Equitable Growth and Housing Committee Chair Mark Jeffries said, you know, we have an affordable housing crisis in the city. He pointed to reports that about 3,000 school kids in Cincinnati public schools are homeless. And he says, we need those extra 100 units. And, you know, we've got to build affordable housing somewhere. And kind of talks about this theme that council sees of community members kind of pushing back against housing developments, saying, you know, we really have to focus on bringing as much housing as possible to the city.
Were there any community members there to respond to those concerns that he raised?
Yes and no. So the president of the Walnut Hills Area Council, Mona Jenkins, was there at council. She actually spoke before these comments were made. So she spoke to the committee in support of the zoning change and said, you know, they were happy with how the developer had made changes to the project based on feedback, and they were supporting the zoning change so the project could move forward. But she did say, you know, her concern was kind of broader about the connected communities zoning changes that were approved last year, and basically challenged city council to keep listening to the community. So, you know, saying, referencing Hyde Park, of course, there's a very controversial development happening there with decisions coming up soon. And basically saying, you know, the community is the ones who are living with these projects. We are there. We live this every day. And she says, we're happy with this outcome, but we need City Hall to continue to listen to us as well on future projects and in other neighborhoods.
You mentioned this was for a zoning change. The developer went to council for the zoning change. Did the developer get that zoning change approved?
They did. It was a pretty straightforward zoning change. You know, it's kind of an empty wooded lot right now, zoned for like manufacturing. There's some other manufacturing nearby. So basically just a basic zoning change to move forward. So there are still lots of other approvals and design decisions that need to be made in this process.
How quickly could this get built?
Probably not very quickly. So in talking to the developer about their financing plan, and they are planning to go for state low-income housing tax credits. That's kind of a newer program with the state. I asked about other funding sources, and they said in a lot of ways they couldn't even ask for money for this project until they had the zoning change. So they're still very early in the process on this, especially in coming up with the money needed to build it.
Yeah. So it's not something that's going to go up in the next few months or...
Definitely not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I have been talking with WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Thank you so much for your time today, Becca.
Thank you, Lucy.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.